Hello, college football fans. Welcome to episode 170 of College Football Throwdown. I'm your co-host, Alex Schmitz, and today I'm joined, as always, by my dad, Peter Schmitz.
Hello, Husker fans and college football fans.
And for the record, we are recording this on Thursday, January 11th in the evening, because things are moving so fast and furious with college football right now. Who knows what it'll be in a few days. But we are here to talk about Michigan's victory over Washington in the national championship game, as well as the coaching carousel that has suddenly been accelerated to 500 with the departure of Nick Saban from Alabama. So there's a lot to get to today.
A lot to get to. Yep. And it's going to prompt us to have a few more podcasts because there's so much college football to talk about and decipher.
Yes. And this is a father-son duo here to talk about college football by college football fans for college football fans. Usually we're here to talk about the Nebraska Cornhuskers, but as Dad mentioned, we'll save the updates in that world for a separate podcast. This one's just going to be about national topics, about the championship game, and all that fun stuff.
Right on.
There you go. Now, before we dive into this particular episode, we're going to stick with our tradition and open up a beverage. This one's for the Wolverines. I've got myself my Japanese Sapporo beer here.
Uh-huh. And I got a Yingling again. So I'm drinking. It's a light beer, though. It's a light beer this time. So I'm trying to, you know, work on my figure.
So there you
here
go.
Here we go.
All right. Cheers.
Slim possible, I believe, is the term.
Yes.
All righty.
Yes, yes. And we should mention that your friend Brian, who has been on the podcast a few times before and is an avid Michigan fan, of course, has been over the moon these past few days with Michigan's victory. And we're hoping to have him on a future episode to kind of get his thoughts on the season overall, the game, and, you know, what's going to happen with the future of the program.
Right, right. Well, and you know, a lot of things are going to start happening. There's going to be some people that are going to, you know, make themselves eligible for the draft and maybe some portal entries. And then, of course, all the rigmarole around Jim Harbaugh, which has become an annual tradition there in Ann Arbor as to whether or not he stays or goes.
That's very true. But yes, we're going to start things off with the national championship game. On the previous podcast, we gave our usual predictions. I predicted that Washington would win 31-24, while you predicted that Michigan would win 28-17. And the final score ended up being a little more lopsided than either of us thought, with Michigan winning 34-13. Now, I should say that, obviously, I grew up in Michigan and everything, so in a normal year, I probably would have been rooting for Michigan to win. But because of the sign stealing thing and all that sort of stuff, I was kind of preferring Washington to win because they didn't have any baggage on them. You know, it'd be nice for the Pac-12 to have a victory as they go out the door. And I genuinely thought after how well Michael Penix played against Texas, that his arm could give Michigan some serious trouble. But turns out I was wrong about that one.
Well, I tell you, I mean, you weren't the only one. I was equally expecting, you know, Michael Penix to perform at a high level like he has done pretty much all year, and particularly impressive in that Texas game the previous week. But that Michael Penix did not show up. And, you know, obviously you want to give credit to Michigan and Michigan's defense for the game plan that they put together, because that Penix was never comfortable the whole game. Now, interestingly, even though that we say that and it's obvious to both of us, that game was a 20-13 game until quite late. It was a game that was very winnable, right, for Washington, even as badly as they played, until quite late in the game.
Oh, yes. That was very much true. And I will just mention here that with our predictions that we were giving previously for the various bowl games and the playoffs, I was leading 8-7 compared to you. But with your victory over me in this championship game, we are both at 8-8. So it's a tie this year on the prediction Woo-hoo! Game. So congratulations.
Yay. Yeah, well, no, that's terrible. nothing like it. I mean, that's what do all football fans hate? A tie.
That's true. That's true. But yeah, when you look at the the stats for the game. Washington had 17 first downs to Michigan's 16. Washington was 2 of 14 on third downs, while Michigan was 1 of 10. Now, Michigan did end up out-yarding Washington 443-301. And then Washington ended up having 2 turnovers, while Michigan had 0. Both teams had 5 penalties, about the same time of possession. So, yeah, it really was a close game, and there were quite a few opportunities that Washington had that they weren't able to capitalize on. Right at the beginning of the game, they had a nice drive down into the 10-yard line, but then couldn't get it the touchdown, had to settle for a field goal. And then there was that later drive where they went for it on fourth down and had Odunze, their receiver, wide open, and Penix just missed him, and that would have been a touchdown.
Right. There were really 2 plays in that first half where Penix just flat out missed a receiver who was open that would have been critical plays. If not a touchdown, I mean, big plays, right? And so it's just, you kind of look at each other and say, what the hell happened there?
Yep. Well, and you had mentioned, I believe, on the previous podcast, how you and Brian kind of had a debate about what Michigan's strategy should be. You know, should they be more Iowa-like, or should they be more aggressive on defense, you know, to try to stop Penix? And turns out they kind of went more the Iowa route. They didn't blitz a ton. Dropped guys back to cover and were basically kind of daring Washington to run it. And we're managing to get pressure on Penix, even though they weren't blitzing, because their defensive line was just playing great that night. And Washington's offensive line, which won the Joe Moore Award for best offensive line in the country, didn't perform that great.
Exactly right. And again, that gets back, I think, to, you know, the kind of defense that's played in the Big Ten Conference. And Washington's going to begin to experience that on a more regular basis in the years to come. And maybe we'll see that play out, you know, a little bit, but the bottom line is that, yeah, I really, with all the success that Michigan had being aggressive against Alabama, you know, for them to choose, they obviously knew a couple of things. I mean, and Brian picked up on this. Brian was right on with how Michigan was going to defend Washington. He expected and predicted that they would kind of play that Iowa bend but don't break. Put a lot of people back and just squeeze the pocket with 4 guys and occasionally bring a 5th, you know, and that's pretty much what they did. And I'm just amazed that that was enough to make Penix uncomfortable. I thought that if you did that with the offensive line that Washington had, that they would be able to secure enough time for Penix that he would be able to be comfortable. And you didn't want a guy with that kind of accuracy to be comfortable. But actually, the opposite actually was true. I think they confused him. They did a great combination of changing up coverages. I mean, they would make things look the same. And sometimes it would end up being, you know, cover 2 or cover 3. Other times it'd be man coverage. You know, they were just doing enough different things and not showing the same look that Penix was never able to recognize and identify what was going on, and then, you know, respond accordingly.
Yeah. Well, and I remember one other play in the second half where on replay, you could see that Penix had a dude open that if he had the time to see him was another easy touchdown. I think that time Michigan did blitz and he had to go to his check down. Yeah. Receiver, you know, had to get the ball out fast. So, you know, once again, it goes to show if you give him time, he can make things happen. If you let him be comfortable, he can throw dimes like he was in that Texas game. But they pressured him enough that he never got into a rhythm the whole game. And admittedly, his receivers would occasionally drop a pass, you know, like he would get a good one to him and then they would just not pull it in. And I think I even saw a quote from Penix afterwards saying that, like, basically, I don't think Michigan did that much special. We just didn't execute, you know.
That certainly it was my perception as the game was unfolding, is I couldn't see anything that Michigan was doing that was all that fancy, other than the fact that they were being unpredictable, right? They weren't just sitting in one coverage in the secondary. They were changing things up. Sometimes they were in man, sometimes they were in zone. But that's not a new concept. People do that all the time. But for whatever reason, their offensive line was confused. Now, On the other side of the ball, you know, Michigan early in the game, you know, one of the reasons why they ended up, you know, whatever it was, 1 for 10, you said, for on third downs,
right,
is because they didn't have very many third downs in the better part of the first half. I mean, they were getting first downs in two plays. They were, I don't know the breakdown of the first half statistics, but in that first half, Michigan was using a lot of bunch formations with multiple tight ends, or even if it was a wide receiver, they were bringing them in tight so that they could use them in the blocking scheme and just loading things up and then daring Washington to match them, right? And then when they would, they would either run to the strength, or occasionally they ran to the off side. And in either case, Michigan was dominating, just dominating. The holes were huge. Guys were running open and oftentimes didn't even get touched by a Washington player until well past the line of scrimmage. I mean, it was just it looked like it was going to be a complete blowout, but then it changed.
Yeah. Well, that's one of the stats that definitely sticks out to you when you look at the sheet, which is that Michigan had 303 rushing yards on 38 attempts, while
right.
Washington had 46 rushing yards on 20 attempts. And obviously their main running back, Dylan Johnson, entered the game already injured, and then he tweaked his ankle right on his first play of the game. And they kept him in, and fair play to the guy. You know, he's clearly a tough dude, and he was fighting through it, but he did not have his same explosiveness, and they right. really didn't have another guy who was better than him. So they really weren't able to threaten a running game the whole game, whereas Michigan was confusing Washington early on, like you say, with those shifts and formations and stuff. And Donovan Edwards, who has been quiet all season, of course, has a couple of huge runs in those first two drives, like get Michigan up 14 points real quick. And yeah, it was looking like it might have been a blowout there going into the early second quarter.
Well, and I feel like then Michigan got away from that. Now, they did continue to try to run the football, but they stopped running out of those power formations, and Washington's defense adjusted, and all of a sudden they weren't able to run it with nearly the ease that they were earlier in the game. And that's typical. I get it. Most, you know, if you're competing against a good team, even if you have found something that of a weakness on their side of the field, that they're going to adjust and close that down. And that's exactly what Washington did. But I think that Michigan played into that a little bit by trying to change up formations maybe too much and spread it out and try to throw the football more when they didn't have to. I would have stayed in those power formations until those guys were able to consistently stop me. Not once. When they get lucky and fill a gap or blitz a guy in the right spot and they blow up one running play, that doesn't mean they've solved your running game. You know, they need to do that on multiple occasions. You need to give your offensive line, you know, the opportunity to demonstrate that was a one-up type of deal when they get one stop. But Michigan didn't do that.
Yeah, there were a few times on third down or even on fourth down where Michigan was at, you know, 3-4 yards and they would throw it instead of running it, which kind of made me raise my eyebrow. But also you could tell one of the adjustments Washington made was they started to kind of stack the box and were kind of daring them to throw it. And J.J. McCarthy was not having a great night throwing it. Now, he ended up with 140 yards, and he was 10 right. of 19 in terms of completions and attempts. But I want to say that number was closer to like 80 before that big pass he had in the fourth quarter, right, that kind of blew the game open.
Right. Well, and he had a couple of critical running plays, too. So J.J. J.J. made them pay for not, you know, defending him in the pocket a couple of times too, which, you know, that's a nice little thing to have, right? With your, as an offensive coordinator, when you know your athlete at quarterback can cause damage like that to the other team. But yeah, you're exactly right. I get loading the box, but if they were really loading the box that much, then Michigan should have been able to do play action pass and have somebody running down the field wide open. Right. Then it would have been an easy throw for JJ, and it wasn't.
Right.
I mean, at least not until very late in the game.
And once again, to give credit to Washington's defense, after looking like a sieve early on, right, and letting a lot of things through, after they held Michigan to a field goal with about 13 minutes left to go in the second quarter, they really didn't give up any more points of their own accord until 7 minutes were left in the fourth quarter where they gave up that touchdown. The only other points in there were a field goal in the beginning of the third quarter that was given up because Penix threw an interception on the first play of the second or the third quarter, I should say, and gave Michigan great field position. So there's nothing you can really do about that. And they kept them to a field goal.
Yeah, that was a great defensive stand to keep them to a field goal in that scenario, right? You turn the ball over on basically the first drive of the second half. And then your defense is forced to, you know, quick change and they hold them to a field goal. That's, you got to say, that's good stuff, right? That's very good. I was impressed with what Washington's defense was able to do. And so it's still a head scratcher. What the heck was going on with Washington's offensive line, who had won all these accolades as being such a dominant group? They just couldn't seem to get it done. But And here's the other thing. You mentioned it a little bit earlier, Alex. How does a team like Washington not have, you know, at least another running back or two that you could put in your starter's place who was at least able to adequately run the football as opposed to trying to put a guy out there who basically is running on one wheel? I mean, that guy, you know, he was very obviously limping. You know, even when he was trying to shift during pre-snap, you know, shifts and motion, it was obvious. I mean, I'm sorry, you got to get that guy off the field, and you have to have somebody else on your team in a big game like this that you can go to. You've had weeks to prepare. You knew he was injured. There had to be another player.
Right. And then they did run some other guys, I recall, but, you know, none of them really did anything very explosive, right, or were particular difference makers. But at the same time, you know, maybe in retrospect, you do give those guys more touches because at least if they made a guy miss, they would have enough to, you know, get a first down plus, whereas Johnson clearly, like you say, was limping all over the place.
Yeah, well, or and blocking, you know. Right. Maybe you pick up a block or you help – chip off of one of your offensive linemen so you can buy a little more time for because you're healthy, right? You can get there. You can physically, I don't know. It just seemed strange to me. They must have really not had much confidence in those other players.
Yeah. So Washington was 27 of 51 in terms of their completion percentage for a total of 255 yards of passing, which is obviously a far cry from the 400 yards they had against Texas previously. So when you're not getting the same crazy passing game going and your rushing is really struggling and you end up throwing two picks, the second of which, of course, was near the end of the game, which was Washington's kind of last chance, and the guy returns it basically all the way back to like the 5-yard line of Michigan to give them an easy score. I mean, at that point, the game was totally over. But, you know, it was at least an entertaining game, even though it was kind of ugly. You know, there was a stretch there in the third quarter where I think there were six punts in a row between both teams because it was just both defenses were battling it out. But Washington kept it within 7 points, and you know that Penix has the ability to throw those dimes and has those great passes in him. So there's always the chance that he would get a big one and suddenly the game would be interesting, right? It just never quite happened.
That is exactly right, Alex. It just never quite happened. Like, people were kind of waiting for that moment, waiting for that big play or whatever to happen, that explosive play, and they never were quite able to make it happen. And that's, you know, again, you got to credit Michigan's defense for that, you know, their ability to confuse him, but it sure looked like Penix was struggling with confidence, with, you know, just seeing the field, whatever you want to say. He was not comfortable at all playing that game. Maybe the moment was just too big for him and he was, you know, nervous. And so he just didn't have a clear head. I can't really explain it, but Michigan made that happen.
Yeah. And I do need to call out the ACC ref crew that was running this game. Now, clearly they were letting the boys play, as they say, right, and not being as ticky-tacky with calls, because there was a lot of pushing and shoving on both sides and holding. You know, I saw a lot of times on the replay, yeah, you could see that, like, the dude's jersey is being visibly tugged and they didn't call it, you know. But I'm like, you know, for me, it's like, if as long as you're consistent with it, you know, on both sides of the ball, then okay, that's just the way we're playing this game, you know, whatever. But then in the fourth quarter, Penix finally connected with Odunze for like a big 30-plus yard pass. And then right, there was an offensive holding called on one of Washington's offensive linemen for what I thought was a very loose or, you know, kind of subtle grab. You know, you could see what they were talking about, but when you've called the whole game being letting the boys play and not calling those kind of things, to call it in that moment, I thought was not great and not very fair. And it really killed the momentum for Washington, because I think they then had to punt on that series, right, when it could have been the start of a scoring drive.
Right. That could have been the moment, right, where they energize and that play sparks them, right? And you're exactly right, Alex. It really is about consistency, and you can't change up the magnitude of what you're going to allow and not allow. Now, that presumes that these referees are seeing all of this holding in real time, and that then at some point they decide, well, that particular holding I'm going to call. And that's probably not the case. The reality is that the refereeing crew, you know, there's two guys within the crew that are particularly assigned the responsibility of looking for holding, right? And there's a third one kind of looking for it inside, on the inside players. But those two outside guys needed to be seeing that all game, right? And so if you're seeing it all game, then you need to let that go. If you're not seeing it, where the hell are you looking? Right. I mean, what are you doing? And so it does. But I think you were heading towards the point that, you know, overall, other than those couple of occasions, you know, the crew left themselves out of the game, right? Unlike some other crews that can tend to get too involved and influence the outcome too much. But I'm always a fan of actually, let's just play the game by the rules. How about we do that? You know, that's what I wish we would get. And I feel like we don't. And part of that is my own bias towards the definition of holding in today's modern football versus what it was back when I played. Right. And it's obviously very different, but I think to the detriment of the sport.
Right. Well, and in this case, because like on passing plays, right, they were, you know, kind of allowing the defensive backs to, you know, touch the receiver, yeah, you know, be kind of physical, at least at the beginning of the route, you know, and that kind of thing. That kind of, yep, disadvantages the team that's really relying on passing more, right?
Correct.
So I think, once again, I can see a Washington fan, you know, bringing that up. But like you say, in, you know, the game was close enough, you know, you can't say that like one bad call swung, right, the whole game, right? Washington had numerous opportunities to get something going, and Michigan's defense was just too stout.
And fundamentally, it wasn't a bad call. As the play was reviewed, a guy clearly held. It was a holding. Your point is that type of holding was occurring throughout the game and not being called. And even worse examples, yes, not being called. So it's about the consistency of that particular infraction that comes into play. And that's where you hope that the referees are going to see enough of it that they're gonna call it, and over the course of the game, it's gonna balance out and be viewed as consistently refereed. But I could see where, as a Washington fan, you might be a little perturbed at that crew and the way that played out.
Yeah, but overall, you know, it was a generally entertaining you know, national championship game. Not our best, certainly, but not our worst either. You know, anything's better than what we had to watch last year. And of course, the Michigan fans were out cheering in Ann Arbor, you know, all night long afterwards. Apparently, the game got 25 million views, which is the highest in 4 years for a national championship game, which I think is a good sign, you know, seeing some fresh blood in there, clearly invigorated some attendance. And in terms of the stadium itself, it felt like it was like 70% U of M. They were definitely there in droves.
Yes. They were.
And this is the first championship for Michigan since 1997 when they shared the championship with Nebraska. So it's been 26 years. It's pretty incredible. And this is something I definitely want to talk to Brian about when we get to talk to him with Jim Harbaugh, because you recall that we had Brian on in the early days of the podcast when Jim was kind of struggling, right, and having some up and down seasons. And in his first 6 years with Michigan, his record was 49-22, so a 70% win rate. And then the last 3 years, he's gone 40-3, a 93% win rate. So he's been in the semifinals now 2 years in a row before this, but wasn't able to make it happen. Finally happens this year. Now, how much of that is due to the sign stealing and all that sort of stuff that Michigan was doing? You know, that's what people will debate now in this offseason, but credit to the athletic director there at Michigan for sticking by Jim, even when the water was getting hot, you know, back in that 2019 kind of time period, 2020, and sticking with him. And now he's brought Michigan back to the summit.
Right. Well, and that's what they brought him there to do. Right. And he's done it in at times in a way that was unorthodox or not viewed positively by everyone and that sort of thing. And, but to say that the athletic department stuck by him, they actually squeezed him pretty good. They cut his pay, you know, they put some stipulations on him and stuff, but to his credit, he didn't, you know, leave at the first opportunity. He stuck it out and he fought and he improved and, put his team in a position to be here. Now we'll wait and see what happens with the yet to be defined penalties that are coming their way from some of the investigations that are not yet complete, and whether or not those will, you know, ultimately be reassigned to this year's team. You cannot ignore what this team overcame, right? I mean, they, as a team, they had to overcome a lot of adversity from external things, not on the field. Heck, even you know, my Michigan fan friends would say this was clearly one of the easiest schedules Michigan has ever had, you know, like in their lifetime, right? So they will acknowledge that they didn't have a lot of big time opponents that they had to rise to the occasion on. You know, obviously the Penn State game was a very critical game for them. The Ohio State game always is the big game. As well as Michigan State, you know, there's been so many years when Michigan State was not viewed as the better team and yet found a way to rise up and beat Michigan. So, you know, they did have those, but their non-conference slate was pretty easy. Even their conference foes, as the, you know, unbalanced scheduling that we have in a conference like the Big Ten happens, Michigan had, you know, got a lot of the right teams at home, the right teams away. So their overall season schedule was not very daunting, but they did what they were supposed to do. They thumped everybody, right? They pretty much dominated the teams they played.
Right. Well, yeah, and I'm looking back at it now. They did play close with Penn State. They only won that one 24-15. And they had a close one with Maryland, as you'll recall, which was right before the Ohio State game, 31-24.
Right.
But yeah, their non-conference this year was East Carolina, UNLV, and Bowling Green. Yeah, so not exactly a row of killers there. And then, yeah, they played some teams like us, Rutgers, Minnesota, Indiana, Purdue, you know. So, yeah, not the toughest schedule, but to their defense's credit, they held all the teams they played this year to under 25 points, averaging only 13 points scored on them the whole season. So I don't know who the MVP of that national championship was. It was probably McCarthy, but I think it really should have been given to one of those defensive guys, because they're clearly what, you know, defense wins championships, as they say, and they're clearly what really let Michigan to this great season.
Yeah, I would agree. And that was the thing with Michigan is that they didn't have any obvious weakness, you know, and that's the hallmark of a great team is that there isn't a weakness that an opponent can attack that is obvious. You're going to have to work hard to find, you know, the weaknesses on a team. Then that's an example. And so they kind of proved that, well, you know.
Maybe their weakness is punting.
Yeah. But it wasn't against us. And I think throughout the whole season, he wasn't necessarily a bad punter, but you're right. In a couple of the key games late in the season and obviously the playoff games, he was less than stellar.
Yeah. Well, it was funny too. The Washington guy's punter, he wasn't kicking it very far, but he would get a bounce that would end up bringing the punts pretty far. So they were definitely winning the punting battle in general.
Exchange. Yeah. Yep. You're right. Just to look at it overall, you know, I think Michigan clearly demonstrated that they were the better team on that night. It's actually, you know, if we look at some larger implications, it's a positive implication that, you know, basically the two teams in the finals are future Big Ten opponents. There was not an SEC team in the final, and it still drove great audience numbers. It was one of the, you know, higher ranked championship games of recent years. And although the Michigan-Alabama game from the previous week actually drew a larger audience than the national championship game did, but they were close.
Yep, that is true. That is true. And it's, you know, of course, we're happy to see that the Big Ten is in the national championship game this year, not the SEC. One of the cool things I've seen being noted is that on these talent rankings, right, in terms of, you know, what were the recruits when they were brought into the program, you know, were they five stars, that kind of thing. Michigan is actually lower down on that ranking compared to a lot of the other national championship teams, right, like your Georgias, your Alabamas, your Clemsons, you know, in recent years. And yet, you know, they still managed to win this championship game. So I think that gives hope to people that, you know, you can develop talent and it's not all about getting the five stars, right?
Right. Well, you know, I think the real message is you don't have to have the top five ranked recruiting class every year like Alabama does or Georgia does, but you do need to have top flight talent. So you have to be in the mix. And Michigan happens to be a team that, you know, they have a year or two where they might be top five talent, but then they'll have a year or two where they're top 15, top 20 talent, right? They don't have the 5 or 6 years in a row stacked on top of each other with five tier talent. And in this age now of the portal, right? The reality is it's not just about what your recruiting talent is. It's about being able to pick up the guys that end up being the true demonstrated talent after they get to college, because now with the portal and your ability to fill gaps and fill depth requirements or depth needs through the portal is equally important to how well you do at recruiting, you know, high school athletes. You really have to be able to mesh those two things together and create a culture where kids don't immediately abandon the program because you recruited somebody into their room that's a portal guy.
Right.
So that's where this whole thing has changed dramatically. How you maximize the benefit of the portal, because I don't think you can not use the portal. I think you have to be strategic about where you use it and the circumstances that drive that. And Michigan has actually not been a huge portal team, right? Like they haven't lost a lot of guys and they haven't necessarily gone out and got a lot of guys. Although where they have got guys, they've been difference makers on the offensive line, you know, where it's hard to get a good portal guy. You know, two years ago, they had two starters that were portal guys. Out of their five offensive linemen. So Michigan's done a really good job of that.
Yeah. Yep. Now, of course, with Jim Harbaugh, there's always the question of, is he going to stay or is he going to go to the NFL in between the sign stealing investigation and the crazy coaching carousel that's going on right now in both the college world and the NFL world? It's very much in doubt right now, but we'll talk about that a bit later as we dive further into what's going on in the coaching world. We did want to give a quick mention to the College Football Hall of Fame, this the next class was announced here in this past week, and one of the additions is Frank Solich, Nebraska's former coach and coach at my alma mater, Ohio University, for many years. Frank was honored, obviously, earlier this year by Nebraska at the spring game, and it was great to see that the wider world of college football is also honoring a coach that's been in the game for a long time. So that was nice to see.
Well, and what people who haven't been following the sport as long as, say, I have, you know, your dad, Frank was an incredible player, actually, for his size. He was remarkable. He was all Big Eight fullback at his size. But then Frank was the best running backs coach in the country. And if you think about the lineage of Mike Rozier and Amon Green and, I mean, Ken Clark and Roger Craig and Tom Rathman and, you know, I Am Hip. I mean, the list goes on and on and on of really excellent running backs that have come through the program at Nebraska, all of whom were coached, or many of whom were coached by Frank. Tom's first running backs coach was another guy, Corrigan, was his name, but Frank was the freshman. He was the freshman team coach initially, back when there were freshman squads, and he was great at that, and really actually cut his head coaching chops, if you will, as the head of the freshman program for Nebraska. But just an outstanding coach, great competitor, and it's great to see him get recognized in the Hall of Fame.
Yes, very much agreed. And there's one quick thing about Michigan and Jim Harbaugh that I need to mention. I'm sure Brian was very happy to see this the day after Paul Feinbaum went on his program and said, quote, "I don't know if I've ever been more wrong about anything in my entire life," because he was very much a Michigan down player.
Yeah. Well, Paul Feinbaum is an idiot. So the fact that, you know, I would have, as much as I've have not necessarily been all in on Michigan this season because of not only the sign stealing, but just all of the issues surrounding that program. The coach who was, you know, changing grades or trying to change grades, and they had to boot him off the staff. I mean, the whole sandwich gate, you know, Burger Gate, whatever you want to call it, with Harbaugh and him not, you know, being forthright with the NCAA. I mean, there was just a lot of turmoil around that Michigan program, you know, the whole year, right? So I was not a fan of Michigan this season, and yet they overcame it all, right? So you got to give the team, the players, the leadership on that team a lot of credit.
Very true.
Holding that together.
And the assistants for stepping up when, like, Jim Harbaugh was suspended for, I want to say it was six games of their regular season.
Right. He was suspended for the first three, right?
Right.
He came back for the Nebraska game. That was his first game back.
Of course.
And then he was suspended for the last three. So you're right. I think it was six regular season games. But again, these suspensions where the suspension is just not allowing him to be there on game day is a joke.
Right.
Any head coach worth his salt, and Jim is definitely a good head coach, is making 99% of his decisions, you know, basically Sunday through Friday. And the game day, everybody knows what they're supposed to do. The assistants all have their jobs. And with the exception of three or four decisions that he might make on game day, the 99%+ of his decision making and leadership choices are happening on all the other days.
Yes.
And he wasn't suspended for those.
Right. Yeah. We've talked about that before. So it seemed that, Alabama obviously lost to Michigan in the semifinal game, but perhaps their final little act of revenge was only giving Michigan one day in the spotlight to soak in all the headlines and the adulation over winning the national championship. Before on Wednesday this week, it was announced that Nick Saban would be retiring from Alabama, of course, soaking up all of the news coverage thereafter.
Right. Yes.
And it's ironic when you and I were together for the holidays this year, we talked a bit about Saban and when he might retire. And I was kind of the opinion that as long as his health is okay, he would keep going for several more years because it seemed like, you know, he was kind of addicted to coaching, right? He keeps him young, that whole thing. But sure enough, it was announced that he'll be retiring at age 72 after this season of college football. His total lifetime record is 292 wins, 71 losses, and one tie. He actually won five more games on the field, but those games were removed from his official record because of a previous scandal at LSU that saw a few of his wins vacated. But, of course, there's been lots of scrambling over who Alabama's next head coach is going to be, and also reminiscing on the man who will probably be considered the greatest of all time coach in college football for a long time to come.
That is true. And, you know, as much as I want to dislike and diss on Saban, I'm sorry, I almost called him Nick Satan because that's my favorite word to describe him because of some of the things that he did that I think negatively took the sport in a direction that was not healthy for the sport. And I think that he is a great coach, though. There's no way you can deny that. And he is a great leader from the standpoint of recognizing the circumstance he was in, figuring out how he could maximize within the rules of that, and including bumping right up against the edge of those rules and maybe even going over them a little bit. And he was successful in that endeavor for over a long period of time, and thus allowed him to have that level of success. In fact, I saw an interview of him that he's done since announcing, and he said basically that, you know, it's a lot harder to sustain a successful program than it is to build a successful program. And I think that's accurate. And I think that's also something that Tom Osborne said on numerous occasions, and other, you know, very successful coaches have said, Mike Krzyzewski, for a basketball analogy, it is a lot harder to sustain and keep everyone within a program, you know, focused and energized and not taking a breath, you know, and always feeling the challenge and the demand. That's a tough thing for a leader to do.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And of course, Nick Saban has won seven national championships. So he's won the most national championships of any coach in kind of the modern era of college football. He won 11 SEC championships. He was at Alabama for 17 years and went 201-29 in those 17 years. Started way back in 1990 as the head coach at Toledo, and was a, you know, assistant and graduate assistant even before then. So he's been in the game for a long time. And aside from a 7-6 start in his first year at Alabama, he's never lost more than three games in the year since then. Usually only losing two or one or none, you know. Right. So yeah, like you say, his reign of success, especially in this new era we're going into with the transfer portal and everything, it's hard to imagine that another coach will be able to sustain that kind of same level for over a decade like he managed to do.
I would agree. It's going to be a record. It's going to be very hard for any individual coach to accomplish in the future. At least I hope that's true. If it does get, if somebody does duplicate it, it'll probably mean that, you know, these attempts like the 12-team playoff, et cetera, have failed to create a competitive environment in the sport. You know, that would be the thing that might cause somebody to achieve a similar level of dominance, would be if, you know, if the NIL thing goes unchecked and at some point somebody just figures out that they can just buy their way to a championship, and then some school chooses to just do that on a regular basis.
Right. And it should be also mentioned that he was the runner-up in three championship games in the past decade or so.
Right.
So he could have been up to 10 national championships by that record.
Right.
And it's also been mentioned a lot of his charitable efforts, you know, there in Tuscaloosa in the state of Alabama. You know, he's got like a children's charity drive that he does. And I saw a comment from some Alabama alumni just talking about how the success of the football program has then transferred into success of Alabama just as an overall university, as an academic institution in terms of their facilities and all in all sorts of ways he's affected that school.
Well, the most significantly, and it is the perfect example of why the football program and the athletic success is the front porch. It's the front door of the university. Alabama's college during an era when many colleges are lucky to maintain their population or have declined enrollment. Their enrollment has gone up 10,000 students during that same time frame, and Nick Saban has a lot to do with that. He put the University of Alabama on the map in the eyes of a lot of people, you know, that wouldn't have maybe even considered Alabama in the days prior to Nick. So do the math on that.
Yep.
I got a great quick story I want to share with you about Nick Saban. It was actually shared by Bob Stoops.
Okay.
And this goes back to when Nick was an assistant coach at Michigan State University back in the 80s, in the mid 80s. And he was in Youngstown, Ohio, which is where Bob Stoops grew up. And, you know, with all the Stoops boys and Bo Pelini, our ex head coach, right? And he was down there recruiting some players. And during one of those recruiting trips, he ended up in a tavern with Bob Stoops's uncle, who was, I believe, the defensive coordinator for his dad at Youngstown Cardinal Mooney High School, which was the big power football program back then. And the two of them got away into the, you know, a corner booth in this tavern and got to talking X's and O's and, you know, really got hot and heavy. And some guy comes into the tavern and holds the place up by gunpoint and, you know, steals all the money and everything like that. And then gets out and gets away, but all hell breaks loose and the cops show up and everything. And they're trying to interview everybody. And the tavern owner says, "Oh, you don't have to talk to those two. They didn't see a thing. They were too, they didn't even know what happened." And to this day, apparently that's a story they tell, that they had no idea that the place had been robbed.
That is classic.
Yeah. And that's the kind of focus and intensity with which, you know, Nick approached every day.
Yes. Well, and I'll have two more quick Saban things before we move on here. One, I saw this quote. Apparently, he'll be getting an office in their in the stadium, the Bryant Denny Stadium. And he said, told some of his players, "I can get on your ass from there just as easily as I can from here." Basically, right. Saying he's still going to be close by, so don't slack off.
Exactly.
And I saw a ESPN interview with Nick from today that was published, where he was basically talking about some of his reasoning. And he says that he and his wife are healthy. It was more so that this season was a drain on him, more so than usual, because Alabama obviously got off to a bad start and had to kind of fight their way back to even make it into the playoff at all. Right. It was a long shot. And he was basically like, "I don't know if I can keep promising to new kids and to coaches and things like that, that I'll be around for several more years, just because it's getting harder to keep up with the work rate and the standards I have for myself." Because as we know, he's a workaholic and he expects a lot from his coaches and he expects a lot from himself too.
Right. Yep. And that was really what it was. Is this, you know, I mean, you think about it, the grind that these coaches, you know, go through, most of them work, you know, 16 hours or more a day, right? Like he talked about, you know, getting home at 2 a.m. and then being back in the office at 6 a.m. and being able to, you know, bring the energy to shout and, you know, be on top of, you know, 120 players, right, throughout a day of preparing for a practice and, you know, breaking down film and doing that day after day after day for an entire season. is remarkable. And the way he worked, I don't think that let up much, even in the offseason with recruiting and everything else. So, yeah, that's brutal.
Yeah, definitely. Now, the joke I've been making today is that all these legendary coaches must be on like a secret text chain or something, and they all conspired to like, let's all leave on like the same 2 days here, because then following Nick Saban's announcement, it's been announced that Pete Carroll is stepping away at the Seattle Seahawks, and Bill Belichick is going to be out at the Patriots as well. So two other legendary, longtime older coaches. Now it's not 100% clear if like, are they actually retiring or are they still going to try to, you know, get a new coaching job? You know, that remains to be seen. But the bottom line is that with the Alabama job opened up in college, you know, that's going to send the college coaching carousel spinning. And the NFL, you have those two big openings plus others that have already previously been announced. So with that, you'd have to think that Jim Harbaugh is sorely tempted to finally accept an offer from the NFL, especially now that he's won his national championship in college, which was obviously a goal of his. On the other hand, you know, he's clearly got a good thing going at Michigan. So if he stays, he'll very much be in contention next year as well. So I could see it going both ways, but I'm kind of leaning more towards he might get out while he's on top. What do you think?
You know, I kind of think that as well. If you're asking me, do I think Jim Harbaugh is going to be the head coach, you know, on September 1st of this year for the next football season, I would say it's less than 50% chance. And it's because of a combination of all those things. I think it has worn on him how he has been, singled out in his mind by the NCAA. He is definitely on their shit list, for lack of a better term. When you're getting pursued for, you know, buying a burger in the age of NIL, you know, the NCAA doesn't like you. And that's number one. Number two is, yes, there's a bunch of openings and he's never, you know, his market value has never been higher for a chance to get back into the NFL. He's checked off his goal of winning a national championship for his alma mater. So he's got that in his, that feather in his cap now. So the idea of him getting back into the NFL just makes a ton of sense. And I don't know that he's in love with this new age of the portal and basically continuous free agency. For the most part, Michigan has not been a major player in that. And it's not something that Jim wants to do. Again, I think he comes from a family of coaches. He's old school and he probably doesn't love this environment that we find ourselves in college football. So for all of those reasons, it just seems like this would be a perfect time to do it. And maybe more practically, you just had a great team. You're going to lose a bunch of players off of that team that are going to go to the NFL and things like that. And then, you know, their recruiting class, although good, was probably one of those years that was a little below standard. They're right there around 20th in the overall rankings for recruiting. So even though they're still going to be very talented next year, they have a class now that they would have to backfill most likely with a number of portal people over the next coming years if they wanted to rise the level of that talent back up to a top 10 level talent on their roster. So he's going to either double down and he's going to be at Michigan for a long time, or he's getting out. And I predict he's out.
Right. So it'd be extra crazy if we have Nick Saban gone, the Alabama job open, and then the Michigan job open as well. Now, in terms of Nick Saban, as we discussed previously off air, he doesn't really have any longtime assistants in major positions currently at Alabama, you know, because his assistants, if they're successful, they often get head coaching jobs elsewhere. So promoting from within doesn't really seem like a likely thing for Alabama. So they're looking from without to see who is available.
He has probably the most impressive, you know, coaching tree of guys that used to work for him, right? That he could choose from if they wanted to go that route. But like you say, on their staff, not so much.
And on that list, some of the names that are being tossed around right now are Dan Lanning from Oregon, Mike Norvell from Florida State, Lane Kiffin from Ole Miss, Kalen DeBoer from Washington.
DeBoer from
Washington. And even Urban Meyer, potentially, who's a former Ohio State coach and currently an analyst.
And I mean, there you put anybody on, I mean, Franklin from Penn State is getting mentioned a lot. And it, you know, it's going to be really interesting to see where they go with this, because I mean, I don't know how high on the list truly DeBoer would be, but I think if he was offered that opportunity, he would jump at it, right? He would seize it immediately. Now, I also thought that the guy from Oregon might be very tempted, because Lanning actually was on the staff. He is part of Nick's coaching tree as a GA. I mean, he wasn't an assistant, but he did, I think, 2 years as a graduate assistant early in his career. And so he knows the Nick Saban way, right? He had 2 years of it.
Yes.
But he has already come out and said, I'm not going, you know, I'm happy at Oregon. Although I've also read reports that even though they did that video and everything like that, that he is, you know, his plane was sighted going to Tuscaloosa or whatever. So who knows? I don't know what to believe on all that media crap, but I could see where a lot of these top candidates, because Sarkisian at Texas, I mean, they're in great shape. Why would you leave Texas? You have all the money and resources and access to athletes that you would at Alabama at Texas. And you're now in the same conference, the SEC. So, and if you go to Alabama, you're going to be under the massive shadow of that, you know, statue outside the stadium, as well as the fact that the guy's alive and has still got an office in the stadium. So I don't want anything to do with that if I'm Steve Sarkisian. I stay at Texas. I would say that same thing is true for a guy like Dan Lanning from Oregon. You know, why would I want to do that? Now, if you're DeBoer and you've not had any connection to Alabama before, then maybe that's less of a thing, right?
Right. So, Steve Sarkisian is also on the list. I forgot to mention him. But the latest I was reading today, and of course, this is all rumors and it'll probably be outdated by tomorrow, but was that Dan Lanning from Oregon said no, Steve Sarkisian from Texas said no, so that Kalen DeBoer from Washington is the new hotness that that they're talking to seriously.
And you know what? If they actually go after him, I think it would be foolish for him not to say yes, because as good as, you know, he obviously played in the national championship game. But again, you're up in the Pacific Northwest. Your access to resources, to athletes, et cetera, is far more limited than it would be at Alabama. You're going into the Big Ten Conference, which was probably going to be every bit as deep and competitive as the SEC. So it's not like there's a big difference in how hard it's going to be to win a Big Ten championship versus how hard it's going to be to win an SEC championship at Alabama with all the Alabama's resources and commitment and everything like that. And they're going to pay you really well, probably quite a bit more than Washington could afford right now. So all of those things point to Alabama. And what's the worst thing that happens? You go to Alabama and you fail. You don't hit the Nick Saban standard and you get fired, which is the most likely outcome, frankly. But in the meantime, you're getting paid a bunch of money, and then you find another landing spot somewhere else and you continue your career if you don't get embraced.
Right. Yeah. And that, of course, has been brought up, you know, you almost want to be not the guy who takes over right after Nick Saban, but the guy who takes over after that guy, right? Because expectations are so high coming off of Nick Saban's reign that it's going to be very difficult for anyone to match up to that, even with all of Alabama's great resources and the talent they currently have in the program. Now, Mike Norvell is interesting because obviously he's done great work at Florida State. But then it was also just announced today that they are getting punished by the NCAA for some NIL violations in regards to like a spring 2022 recruiting event involving like contacting NIL boosters, and the NCAA is being quite strict with penalizing them for that. So you almost right. wonder, A, does that tarnish his brand a bit as a coach? But also B, does that make him maybe want to get out if he was offered the Alabama job?
Right. Well, if you look at the combination of the snub from even getting into the Final Four that FSU just experienced, the fact that the FSU, the university, has been aggressive in its efforts to try to at least give themselves the opportunity to leave the ACC if they want to, and now this with the whole NCAA deal, it just seems like if they wanted to talk to him, that Norvell would absolutely be receptive to the Alabama job. Not that you're looking at it as a safety or a parachute to get you out of a bad situation at Florida State, but rather that it kind of helps you push the reset button a little bit on some things. And he clearly is a good coach who was doing a great job of recruiting at Florida State and things like that. So he's got a lot of the capabilities that you want.
Yeah, very true. So obviously, yeah, we'll keep an eye on how the coaching carousel goes, especially if Jim Harbaugh does jump ship. I couldn't help thinking right. that it may be a blessing in disguise in a way that Nebraska didn't have a great year this year, because you can imagine if Nebraska, you know, had like 9 or 10 wins, right, and played in the Big Ten championship against Michigan, you know, Matt Rhule did this miraculous kind of 1 year turnaround thing, then his name would be coming up a lot in these both college and NFL coaching talks, right?
Absolutely.
Now that's not happening, obviously, based off of our past year. So we get to hold on to him for a while longer yet, but it's something to keep an eye on.
The thing that we have to worry about, there's really just a handful of programs that we would have to worry about Coach Rhule, you know, picking up the phone, so to speak, and entertaining an offer. And two of those for sure are Penn State, his alma mater, and University of Texas. Okay. Because he's highly, highly respected in the state of Texas, did a great job when he was down at Baylor, and Texas with its resources would be a pretty hard invite to pass up if you're Matt Rhule. And the dominoes of the scenario you just talked about. If Jim Harbaugh leaves, all of a sudden the University of Michigan job and the Alabama job are both going to be open at the same time in the same cycle. And let's say, Franklin leaves Penn State to go to Alabama or to go to Michigan, right? Because he thinks he has the ability to win championships better there than if he stays at Penn State. And now all of a sudden Penn State's in need of a head coach. Then we would have to get worried.
Right.
You know, here's another interesting thing to think about. You know, if the idiot at Carolina, you know, who fired Rhule.
Oh, right.
If Rhule hadn't taken this job, you know, he was planning, and most people thought he would just take a year off, and he's so good, you know, with the microphone in his hand, he would have been hired by ESPN or, you know, maybe the Big Ten Network. You know, he would have been on national TV and as an NFL analyst, you know what I mean? And he would have done a great job with it. Right. And after a year on the sidelines, he'd have been chomping at the bit to get back into coaching, and then jobs would have come available. And so there's a very real possibility that if he had not taken the Nebraska job at all, and he had taken the year off like he thought he was going to, then he would have been well positioned to be a part of this conversation, assuming he had not already taken the Texas A&M job. Because I would argue that he probably would have been a major candidate for the A&M job if he hadn't already taken the Nebraska job.
Right. Well, yeah. And speaking of which, obviously, Jimbo Fisher is a big name coach who is out there and available in the coaching pool. So he's definitely, you know, under consideration for some of these big jobs. And in terms of James Franklin, you're right. I've seen him being mentioned in terms of the Alabama job, but I don't think Alabama fans would be too happy with him going there.
Oh, I don't think so either.
The Penn State fans are kind of lukewarm on him. You know, he hasn't exactly lit their world on fire, right? You know, kind of been inconsistent. Right.
Well, his problem is he was in the West or the East Division of the Big Ten Conference. So the only way he was going to make any real noise, he had to overcome Michigan and Ohio State in the same year, right? Like, you had to be better than both of them. And that's pretty damn hard to do. If you happen to catch one of them down, then the other one might still be up or might be way up, which kind of was the case. And but yeah, his problem is he can't win the big one. I mean, he's been very successful, except against Michigan and Ohio State. He just can't beat them. Oh, I think Alabama fans would be furious if they hired him. That's the thing. The athletic director, ironically, who is the son of Nebraska's athletic director of many years, Bill Byrne, the athletic director is Greg Byrne, his son, at Alabama. And so now Greg has to make this decision. And it's going to be tough, because unless they get one of those top three or four, and DeBoer would be, I think, a good choice. He hasn't got a lot of Power Five experience, though. He's only a few years into that. And so he's a risk. There's no doubt. I think Dan Lanning would from Oregon would be an easier sell to the alumni and the fans of Alabama. But Lane Kiffin, to me, is the guy that you need to keep your eye on for that job.
Right. Even though there was some kind of, I know there was some bad blood between him and Saban and Alabama
right,
at one point in time, but you think that can be healed?
Oh, I do. And I think a point made by Mike Farrell, who is a sports recruiting guru of note, who's written an article about this, highlights the point that yes, there was that difficulty. However, he's a guy that has the kind of supreme confidence Kiffin is, that he knows, he was around the Alabama environment. He knows the expectation. He can handle it, and he's just enough of a smartass knows how to manage the portal, all the things that are going on. I mean, what he's doing at Ole Miss right now, he's winning the portal in a huge way, right? At Ole Miss, he's handling that really well, and his ability to manage social media, he's really savvy. So on all of those areas, he would be really good. And he's a brilliant offensive mind. And his defensive coordinator now, that's been with him at Ole Miss, was Nick Saban's defensive coordinator. So there is that tie as well. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. I think he might be the guy that it falls to. You know, if DeBoer were to say no, and Lanning says no, and Sarkisian says no, and, you know, all of a sudden you're looking at, are we going after Franklin, or are we going after some young guy like the offensive coordinator at Michigan, who is also being talked about as a possible replacement for Harbaugh if Harbaugh leaves, because he was the assistant that was elevated when Harbaugh was suspended. So that Moore, I think, is his name. And so he's a guy. And maybe there's a couple of other coordinators who were former head coaches elsewhere. I don't know. There's going to be some other names that'll pop up as that thing trickles down. But I think if they get to Franklin, that will be not a good sign for Alabama.
Right. Yeah, you've gone down the list at that point.
Right.
All right. Well, obviously, we'll keep an eye on this coaching carousel as we get into the off season here. Sadly, the college football season has come to an end, so we'll less regular with our podcast. But as we mentioned, we've got a lot we want to talk about on the Nebraska side of things with recruiting. We've got a bit of Nebraska basketball to talk about, which we don't usually mention, but something big happened this week. And then there are updates in regards to NIL, including some new rule proposals, both by the president of the NCAA and by other committees. And we mentioned the Florida State crackdown that they're doing. So a lot still spinning in the air right now in the world of college football. You know, the NCAA convention is happening as we speak. So there's plenty to still discuss in the offseason.
Right. And Nebraska's been very busy in the portal themselves in these last days before the next semester starts. So it'll be interesting to see how that ultimately all falls together. And it's looking very good at this point for the Huskers as well. So So there'll be lots to talk about on that front as well.
All right. Well, we hope you out there enjoyed listening to College Football Throwdown for this season of College Football Throwdown, or just this episode if you're a new listener. You can reach out to us at HuskerPete13@gmail.com. You can also find us if you search for College Football Throwdown on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. You can leave us a rating or a review there. We always love hearing from the fans. So thank you all out there for listening, and thank you, Dad, for joining me for this episode. And until next time, go Big Red.
Go Big Red.